The chair calls this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. A quorum is present. Members, today we will be hearing four bills on the agenda. We're going to start with Representative Cantrell. So if Ms. Representative Cantrell can bring your folks down. if we do not finish our agenda today during the regular committee meeting, we will reconvene at 5 p.m. or 15 minutes after floor session, and it will be in room 200. So don't come here. Room 200. Okay, if we don't get this done, which it's my intent to get this done. So the first one will be Representative Cantrell, parentage of woman who provides donated ova clarified and rights of spouse and parentage. The plan is to adopt an author's amendment and lay it over for possible inclusion in the civil policy omnibus bill. And then the other three are mine. I don't know how that happened, but they're mine. House files 4, 1196, and 1197, all data. That's right. This is the data day. So, okay. That's why we're doing it. The first item is the approval of minutes from February 27th. Do I have a motion on that? Representative Zhang moves the moments after having thoroughly reviewed them. Is there any discussion on the minutes from February 27th? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of February 27th are approved. Okay, Representative Cantrell, you are up. The chair moves your bill. Where is his bill on here? There it is. Okay.
It's okay. I got it.
So chair moves your bill, and this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the civil law policy omnibus bill. And you have an author's amendment, the A-19. Can I have a motion to put the bill in the form that the author wants? Representative Knorr moves the A-19 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The bill is amended consistent with A-19. Now there's another. Well, wait a second. Is there another amendment, or that was the only one? Oh, okay. Well, let's wait till we get to that spot. When you can start. Why don't you go ahead and start on your bill, Representative Cantrell, and if you want to make minor non-technical oral amendments, we can do that as you explain it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you this morning. the bill that I'm introducing is House File 724, and this bill updates Minnesota Statutes 2018 Section 257.56, which is our currently titled Artificial Insemination Statute. By removing the phrase artificial insemination from the statute and the contents of it, and replacing that term with the more commonly used term, assisted reproductive technology. In the common medical and legal parlance, artificial insemination is considered as more of an obsolete term and is no longer commonly used today. Furthermore, this bill gender neutralizes most of the language in this statute to address a problem frequently experienced by two-mom families who conceive a child or conceive children through assisted reproductive technology. As the law is currently written, the husband of a woman who conceives a child through assisted reproductive technology is treated as the biological parent and enjoys automatic parental rights in regards to the child conceived through this process. However, in a two-mom family, in which one spouse conceives through assisted reproductive technology, the non-birth-giving mother is required to go through an invasive and often costly second parent adoption process in order to gain legal parentage in regard to the child conceived through assisted reproductive technology. This creates significant issues for the family unit and for the child and can be distressing overall. Today I'm joined by several testifiers who will share their experiences and insights and substantiate why this needs to be further clarified in law by the language in House File 724. Mm-hmm. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn the presentation over to my testifiers.
Great. Please come on up and testify and state your name for the record. Introduce yourself to the committee. Welcome.
Hello. My name is Nikki Graff. This is my wife, Whitney Graff, and this is our daughter, Logan. We're here today to ask you to support Bill 724, otherwise known as Logan's Law. Logan was born March 28, 2018, so today she's 11 months old. And as most of you know, being a parent for the first time is one of the best gifts. However, for me and many mothers like me, our first parent experiences are placed with the constant feeling of worry, self-doubt, and the inability to keep my child safe. These feelings were induced by the fact that when she was born, I was not considered her legal parent. My wife and I were married at the time of her birth. My name is on her birth certificate, and we conceived her by an anonymous donor who by law has no legal parental rights to our child. We ensured that every single step was completed correctly, but to be Logan's legal mother, I had to adopt her. The adoption took over a year to be completed, and during that year, I carried the constant reminder that if something happened to my wife, I would lose my child and my partner at the exact same time. During that year, we spent Logan's entire savings on lawyer fees and court fees. During that year, I had to complete a background check with fingerprints to prove that I had no history of abuse or child abuse. And then lastly, during that year, I had to collect letters that were written to the judge from my friends and family saying that I'd be a good mom, that Whitney and I would not get a divorce, and that our home was safe to raise a baby in. On adoption day, the court hearing was 15 minutes. So we waited a year and 15 minutes for a stranger to tell me that I was my child's parent. The current statute on artificial insemination uses gender-specific language that only describes heterosexual families, such as man and woman, husband and wife, mother and father. And because of this, families who don't fall under those categories have to take additional legal action. In other words, mom and dad families who conceive a child the exact same way have legal rights to their child from birth. Sorry, got a baby here. We cannot continue to implement a law that openly hurts families like mine. Forcing a parent to adopt their own child is not the solution to an old law. Changing the words is. The process belittled my first experience ever as a mother, and I won't get that back. From my daughter's perspective, she only knows me and Whitney as her parents. And putting her at risk of losing one of us is completely irresponsible, and we have to do better. By supporting Logan's Law, you're protecting families, children, and first-time parenting experiences. I cannot get my first year back, but together we can work together to make sure this doesn't happen to any other parent or child.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Graff. Whitney Graff, will you be testifying as well?
I will not be.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here. Any questions from members of the committee for the Graffs? Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here, and thanks for bringing Logan as well. Your next testifier, Representative Cantrell.
Chairman Lesh and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of Logan's Law. My name is Davis Sensman, and I'm a parent and lawyer from Minneapolis. When my son was born in August of 2008, there was no way for my name to appear on his birth certificate except through adoption, because the state of Minnesota did not allow his mother and I to be married. The months between August when he was born and February when his adoption was final were as climactic and tiring as the first months of any family with a new baby. But I had the added worry of knowing that if anything happened to my son in those months before the adoption was final, I would likely be unable to be with him. And if anything had happened to his mother in those months, I could have faced losing my son entirely. I was, in the eyes of this state and this country, a legal stranger to my son. Despite my spending long nights up with him as he learned humans are not nocturnal animals, despite my willingly paying for the many things he needed, I had absolutely no relation to him before that adoption. When my son was almost 5 years old, he and I stood on the steps of the building next door and celebrated the fact that same-sex marriage was now legal in Minnesota. And 2 years later, when he was seven, we celebrated as that became the law of the land in this country. My son will be 11 this summer, and despite all of these changes, despite Americans in general and Minnesotans in particular realizing that their marriages will not somehow be lessened if families like mine are also recognized under the law, children like my son are still born as legal strangers to their loving parents because of the wording of this statute. Oddly enough, this statute provides a benefit to one certain group of people. Those are attorneys who handle second parent adoptions, which until recently included my own firm. We are paid several thousands of dollars by loving married couples to file numerous filings with the court and take up valuable and limited resources simply to ensure that the non-gestational parent is not, despite the legality of her marriage, a legal stranger to her child. The judges who continue to hear these 15-minute cases consistently apologize to the families for having to go through this process. One judge recently commented that this issue is, quote, ripe for a 14th Amendment case against this state by the affected women. I urge you to use the power the people of Minnesota have trusted you with to avoid the need for such an expensive resolution and instead to do what this bill asks and amend the statute. And finally, I would like to remind this committee that amending the statute could not only save the individual families that it affects money, but also the taxpayers of this state. Children born to families like mine and Logan's have only one legal parent at birth. Parents like myself and Logan's non-gestational parent have to take the affirmative step of adopting our kids. And this is an expensive and time-consuming process. If we were unable or unwilling to do that, we would continue to be legal strangers to these children. So if something happens to the gestational parent, the child could be left without a responsible adult and could easily end up relying on the state for medical care, housing, or other things children need. Voting to change this statute will be a vote to assure that kids like my son and kids like Logan have two adults on the hook for their many expenses and needs from the moment of birth. For that and all the other reasons stated, I urge you to vote yes on Logan's Law. And I'm happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sensman. The questions from members of the committee from Ms. Sensman. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here. Your next testifier, Representative Cantrell.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Ann Swanson, and I am a mother. I'm a grandmother. I'm a retired psychologist. I'm a wife, and I am a taxpayer. I recently read in the Star Tribune about the language of this law, and I was shocked. I have a lesbian daughter who is married and has a two-year-old. And we all thought they were covered because of marriage being legal. This suddenly became very real for me this morning. My daughter is 35 weeks pregnant with twins and is on her way to the hospital with her wife. And she has a two-year-old at home. And all of a sudden, I thought about the families who don't have the support that my daughters have and my daughter-in-law. What would happen if something, God forbid, happened to my daughter today as she is rushed to the hospital to possibly deliver these babies because of potential complications? God forbid that anything would happen to Bridget. But I know that if it did, I'd be there to support my daughter-in-law. Other families don't have this right. I agree with the testimony about taxes. I pay a lot of taxes, and I want my money to be used wisely, not unnecessarily to do adoption processing and things that would not get changed if this language does not get changed. So I ask you, as parents, grandparents, siblings, to change this language, to protect our kids. Thank you for listening today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Swanson. Any questions for Ms. Swanson? Thank you. Your next testifier, Representative Cantrell. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Bree Murphy. I am the mother of Rowan Avery. This is my wife, Selena. She's also Rowan's birth mother. We're here today representing Logan's Law, but also our own personal family. Ever since I was a child myself, I've wanted to be a mother. Selena and I have been married for over 2 years now, and we've been planning our family for actually even longer. When we first started dating, we talked about having kids and, you know, the likeness as you start dating. Just the same as really any other couple that is interested in having families. We have somewhat of a unique situation is that we both eventually want to carry a child. She went first, and then I'm expected to go next, which I'm very excited. Hopefully will happen soon. Due to that decision, we chose an anonymous donor who represented both of us so that we actually had a tie between not only us but them as well with their DNA. So a lot of planning went into this. Rowan is not an accident. We fully planned to have her, and the day we found out Selena was pregnant, of course, we were so happy that our dream was coming true of being mothers. And then someday, one of my friends came to me and just told me that Rowan was actually not legally mine, and that this dream of being a mother is not legally true. In our hearts and in Rowan's mind, I'm all she knows with Selena as our mothers, as her mothers. And it just broke my heart, of course, because that means that, you know, she, if anything were to happen to Selena, I'm not sure what would happen to Rowan. And the fact that here I thought, since we were legally married and we went through that whole process and making sure that we went through the same things that my straight friends had done, documentation we were filling out already said spouse, so I was very excited. Things were changing. People at clinics and the hospitals were actually crossing off the word father and putting spouse for me. I really thought that this was true and that this was, you know, going forward, until I was told that in the end, it actually, something could happen where Rowan would not actually be mine and I would have to really fight for her. I have not gone through the adoption process yet and would love to not have to go through battling those legal fees, and especially hearing, you know, Nikki's story and us talking, the fact that it could take over a year for a 15-minute decision by someone who doesn't even know how much love we have for our daughter. And then, you know, obviously all the cost that comes into preparing to have another child, you know, on top of that is just a lot. So, you know, we're asking you to please agree with these changes. It would be a huge change for us. And we actually, just over this time, have been educating more and more of our friends that are planning to have families that, you know, you got to start preparing for potential adoption. And we'd love to not have to do that. So thank you for listening to us, for meeting us, and we appreciate any help you can give us.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Murphy. Any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Murphy? Great, thank you. Thank you for being here, bringing your family. Representative Cantrell, do you have another testifier? Okay.
Mr. Chair, it looks like...
Why don't we go to your proposed oral amendments on it. Can you describe where the... What? Oh... Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. So the spouses are listed on the birth certificates?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Considine, yes. Yes, the spouses are listed on the birth certificate, but as I've come to find out, while a birth certificate is sufficient identification information for the individual for whom it is their birth certificate, as far as certifying legal parentage, a birth certificate lacks substantial standing.
Mr. Chair, Councilor?
So we get guys out there that find out later they're not the biological fathers and are trying like hell to get off birth certificates, and they can't do so, and then we have people that are putting their names on the birth certificates and willing to take the responsibility, and they can't do so. That seems a bit odd to me. The reasoning has always been they want somebody to, you know, these guys have had not getting on off, is that they want somebody to assume the financial responsibilities. And you have people that are willing to take the financial responsibilities, and we won't let them. That's a little weird. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Considine. I know, too, that the operative instrument in Minnesota, not just for two women who have a child, but a man and a woman, is a certified recognition of parentage. A lot of people assume that it's that birth certificate, but it really doesn't matter. You got to get the signature on the certified recognition of parentage, which is operative for collecting child support or claiming parental rights at some point later too. And you find out a lot of men who find that out later, and then have to go through a similar process. But any other questions, Chair Constein?
Well, actually, then my question would be for you: if these people got on the certified thing, would that clear it up? Or
well, I think it's a lot smoother the way that Representative Cantrell's bill proposes it, because the situation I'm talking about, where a man finds out, a man has a child with a woman, he wants to later claim rights. This is supposed to operate so that there's a meeting of the minds. We're going to have a child, and they have the same rights as a man and a woman. And it's a lot smoother than to have to jump through the hoops of
whatever's easiest. Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, he's got a good idea here. Okay, so to your oral amendments, Representative Cantrell, what did you want to do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the A19 amendment, heading of 257.56 is artificial insemination, and I would just like to amend that to read assisted reproductive technology.
Yeah, we already adapted it, I know, right? So we have to recall that then, right? Okay. For the A19, we already voted on that, Representative Cantrell. I didn't know you were orally amending the amendment. What's your second amendment? Does that go to the written amendment, or does it go to the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, at this point in time, I only have that one amendment now.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Representative Considine moves to reconsider our motion to approve the A19 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The A19 is reconsidered. Representative Considine also moves the A19 amendment. And Representative Cantrell, your proposal is to change on line 1.4, artificial insemination, to what?
Mr. Chair, to assisted reproductive technology.
Reproductive
technology.
Okay. All right. Any questions about the amendment?
Yeah.
Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this, but why are we injecting technology into this? Maybe assisted reproduction, or I don't know if you've had deep conversations about what this should be, but I just want to make sure that it's maybe staff has an opinion, just so that it's right and not injecting some additional issue into it.
Well, I don't know. I guess, Chair Liebling, I never care when people want to amend section headings because okay. They don't ever matter in statutory interpretation. So you could name that section Bigfoot, and it wouldn't matter.
Okay.
But to your question, if staff can answer, go ahead.
Chair and members, I think that you could use the term assisted reproduction or assisted reproductive technology. I think they would both
okay.
signify what.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, just if we're going to be consistent then on line 1.18, the term assisted reproduction appears again. Are we changing that to assisted reproductive technology as well?
Mary says no. And we go with what Mary says in here, usually. Most of the time. Right.
Well, that's
I'm sorry, Ms. Mullen.
1.14. I'm confused.
This is something we might be able to fix in a revisor's bill, right? Hopefully. Unless it's burning, you really want to do it, Richard
so,
Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I thought I had heard that, in addition to the title, that there was also a change to the term on line 1.14. To change assisted reproduction to assisted reproductive technology. That term assisted reproduction appears throughout this. And I guess my question maybe to the bill author is, are we changing that term throughout this bill?
Representative Cantrell, yes or no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, no. I'm amenable to the title being assisted reproduction or assisted reproductive technology.
Okay. Okay, 1 second. Representative Neal.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, I was just going to say that those two different terminologies are throughout the bill. So it's not just
right.
assisted reproduction technology, but there's also assisted reproduction, and maybe they have a distinction. No distinction difference. So they are just interchangeable. She's nodding. Ms. Mullen's nodding yes. So they're interchangeable.
Okay.
So I guess it'd be up to the author if he wants to keep a consistent verbiage throughout or not. it's really up to him, I suppose.
As I've already mentioned to someone this morning, Emerson stated a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So we don't care. They can be different. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that it would be good to have it to be consistent, and so I would just hope that, you know, maybe we can just do that, because especially, and I would vote for using assisted reproduction because it's shorter, and any time we can make statutes shorter and have it have the same meaning, I'm all for it.
Does the committee really seriously care about this? I'm serious. We'll change it.
We're doing our job.
Okay, fine. If the committee seriously cares about this, we'll ask staff to go through every line where it says that and change it to be consistent. Give me a north-south or something on that. We want to change it all? Okay, fine. Staff, how much of a pain is it going to be to...
Chair and members, I think you can change the heading, so this oral amendment would be at 1.4 to assisted reproduction. And then... On 1.13, you could delete the word technology and change the word reproductive to reproduction.
Okay, and those are the only two on the A19 amendment? Okay, so those are the non-technical oral amendments, the A19 amendment. Did you, Representative Barr, did you have a comment to this?
I have a comment to the, since the amendment's still being considered, but not to this particular piece.
Okay, is there any other comments with respect to the oral amendment on the verbiage? Any other comments? The amendment is, as Ms. Mullen stated, with those two oral amendments. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A19 is amended to the A19 amendment as amended. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is from the original bill to the amendment here on line 1.19 in the amendment and 1.23 in the original bill. They changed married woman. Took it out of one and put it in the other. So in the DE, this would mean that two people that are not married, or two women that are not married, I guess. I was curious to why that was changed. So, you know,
Who is it? Is it Representative Cantrell? Do you have an answer to that, or does staff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, could you repeat the line specifically on the original bill and on the DE, please?
Okay, on the original bill, it's line 1.23, and it's you took married out, so two women that are in a relationship, would both still be on the birth certificate. And in the amendment, your DE amendment, it's on line 0.19 that you left the word married back in. So this would only apply with the DE, this would only apply to married women. Is that the way you wanted that? So I was just curious about that while the amendment's open.
Representative Cantrell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, yes. Yeah, we did mean to include that married language in the DE amendment.
Okay,
just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay, no, Chair Scott.
Since we're there, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to clarify that Subdivision 2 speaks only, and maybe this is a question for staff,
well, wait a second. Is this to the A19 amendment, Chair Scott?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
So it speaks, I just want to verify that it speaks to, that it wouldn't apply to a single woman that wanted to, that used a sperm donor for assisted reproduction.
We just get that clarification. This only applies to married women.
Well, that's what I thought, but I'm just looking at the language and going, well, if you think of that paragraph in terms of thinking of a single woman doing that, I'm not sure the language is there to solidify. But I just want.
So who's your question to?
Ms. Mullen.
Okay, Ms. Mullen, go ahead.
Chair and members, the way it is written right now in this delete everything amendment, the donor of semen or ova provided by a licensed physician for use in assisted reproduction by a married woman. I think that part of the law only applies to a married woman.
Okay, that's good enough for me.
All right.
Any other questions as to the A-19 amendment as amended? Any other questions? No. Okay, all in favor of the A-19 amendment as orally amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. We're in the middle of a vote. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay. Now, Representative Grasso, did you have something?
It just hit me there, Chair, that with that verbiage, could the donors then come back? And I'm sorry I didn't get my hand up soon enough. Could the donor then come back and demand partial custody if it was a single woman?
My understanding is that answer is a flat-out no, but Ms. Mullen, you're the authority on this. Go ahead.
Chair and members, I think the thing to keep in mind is that as far as single parents go or in a situation where people aren't married, the law is not changing. So this law doesn't address it now, and it wouldn't address it under this. But I can talk to the reviser who drafted this and talk to them about what the intention was, but that would be my understanding, that the rest of the law is staying the same. Existing law is staying the same.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Now that we've lawyered the heck out of this, are there any other comments to the bill as amended? Seeing none. Representative Zhang.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cantrell. Thank you very much for carrying this bill. I also want to thank Nikki and her family for bringing this bill forward. I remember it was National Night Out last year, and I was out there with Council Member Jane Prince and got to meet with you both. And then a couple of weeks later, Council Member Jane Prince sent me an email saying, "Hey Jay, remember the family you met a couple of weeks ago? Well, there's an issue here. It's not a city issue. It's a state level issue. So we want you to work on it." And I remember my response was, "Well, I'm not an elected official yet, so I can't really do much about it. But let's talk about it once our session starts." And so, thank you so much, Representative Cantrell, for bringing this bill forward and working on it. And as you all members have heard today, parents like Logan's are not the rightful parents, and it's time for us to pass this bill so that babies like Logan's will be the rightful owners to their moms. And so I really appreciate all your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, I'm still trying to wrap my head around this amendment.
Well, we passed the amendment.
Yeah, or the bill. As a person that's actually been adopted, I understand the process and how important it is and why it takes so long, because they want to make sure it's right for the child. I'm not sure if this is the right way to do this or not. So I just have some concerns on this, and because the FFA was in my office, I didn't hear where this bill was going to next.
It's being laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. I'm going to do some more research on it because, like I say, I do have some concerns.
Okay. Excellent. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Seeing none, then Chair lays House File 724. As amended, over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Thanks for being a representative. And thank you all the testifiers and the folks who came to see this bill through. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all the testifiers.
Okay, so now I better do this right. No, I have a. Okay.
All right, the bill we're going to be hearing next is House File 4, the Prescription Price Gouging Bill. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
I would, Madam Chair.
All right, Chair Lesh moves that House File 4, members. Chair Lesh moves that House File 4 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And so we have the bill before us. Chair Lesh, if you'd like to tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Too many Minnesotans are paying too much or going without life-saving prescription drugs. This is morally wrong. Minnesotans shouldn't lose their lives because they can't afford the life-saving medications they need. Many Minnesotans have to pay prices for prescription medications that are downright obscene. It's wrong that these folks are put in a position where they feel helpless as Big Pharma rakes in record profits from this unconscionable activity. In some cases, people are making life or death choices to forgo needed medications like insulin due to the outrageous cost. Now, y'all remember Pharma Bro, Martin Shkreli. He's sitting in federal prison right now on an unrelated fraud charge. He flippantly boasted about the ease with which he was able to raise prices in an HIV AIDS medication by 5,000%. It's unacceptable that Big Pharma is able to carry so much control over people's lives. And for too long, this legislature and legislatures around the country have prioritized the interests of big pharmaceutical companies, resulting in out-of-control costs for families. We are committed to making affordable health care a reality and tackling prescription drug costs in this legislature. Now, with more Minnesotans telling their stories about how outrageous drug prices have affected their well-being, both physical and financial, I'm confident this can become law, and together we can hold pharmaceutical companies accountable and work to make these prescription drugs more affordable for everyone. So with that, I think I have testifiers.
Yep, sounds good. And just as they're coming up and getting ready here, can you just tell us what committees, Chair Lesh, this has been through already, or how many committees, and what the focus is for us
I
today?
I can't even remember. I think we've been through a baker's dozen. But okay. Like three? We've been through three, I think. I remember we started with Reps and Moran. That was HHS. And then we went to Commerce.
Okay.
And, oh, and we're only here now? Okay, well, three.
And is there a specific area that is the focus of our committee today?
Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, I believe the reason this bill is here is Subdivision 6 and Subdivision 7, which are located on page 9, and they relate to the Attorney General and to the private right of action, which is an enforcement provision for the bill.
There we go.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Mullen. And with that, please bring your testifiers forward. All right, Mr. Gilbert, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Alan Gilbert. I'm a member of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I'm here on behalf of Attorney General Keith Ellison, who strongly supports this legislation. The bill prohibits a drug manufacturer or wholesale distributor of essential prescription drugs from charging an unconscionable price for those drugs sold or distributed by them in the state of Minnesota. The bill responds to various documented abuses in the industry that have resulted in patients not being able to access these critically important medications. This documentation includes, for example, two recent federal government reports issued by the United States Government Accountability Office and the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging. Essential prescription drugs are a necessity. They are life and death for a lot of people. Drug manufacturers and wholesalers are entitled to a fair return on their sale of prescription drugs in Minnesota. But price gouging regarding essential prescription drugs greatly, and I repeat that, greatly jeopardizes the public health and welfare in the state and needs to be regulated. Addressing the high cost of these drugs is one of Attorney General Ellison's most important priorities. And this legislation is extremely helpful in dealing with the issue and protecting the public interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. I believe you have other testifiers.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Holt. Go ahead.
And thank you, committee, for hearing me today. My name is James Holt, Jr. I am a hospital worker at Fairview Softdale Hospital and a member of the executive board of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I am the father of Alec Rayshon Smith. Okay. Alec died June 27th. 2017, as a result of rationing his life-saving medicine. My son was a type 1 diabetic who relied upon the daily injections of the insulin to stay alive as a result of unregulated pharma. Type 1 diabetic has seen the rapid increase of the cost of insulin to go from $21 a vial in 1996 to almost $300 today. The discovery of insulin occurred in 1921, and the first treatment with insulin was given in 1922. Insulin was given to the University of Toronto for $3, and it was understood that insulin was to be affordable to all diabetics, and that it was a gift to the world. Those three scientists did not want to profit off the discovery. They wanted to save lives. The University of Toronto did not have the ability to mass produce insulin, so Eli Lilly took over the production of insulin. And it was understood that any revenues from insulin was to be used to find a cure for type 1. Most type 1s need about 3 to 4 vials a month to survive, as well as many other diabetic supplies, which can also be financial strain. The cost to keep my son alive with insulin and supplies was over $1,300. Currently, 48% of U.S. population is taking one or more meds per month. Many of these people have no insurance or have high deductible plans, which makes it unaffordable of medicines out of reach for many and is causing great financial strain on their families and is leading to many filing for bankruptcy. It is truly frustrating to hear stories that people share with me and my family about how they are obtaining their meds or the dangerous workarounds they are using to stay alive. It is estimated that 1/3 of all medicines go unfilled because of cost. It is estimated that 45,000 people die each year in the U.S. because they can't afford the treatment. In what society is it okay to allow our citizens to go without their medicine? Forcing people to ration life-saving medicine and ultimately die, like my son, from the lack of affordable care. In my book, this is not okay. It is not okay for Big Pharma to go unregulated. In the United States of America in 2017, my wife and myself, the mother and the father of four children, had to hold a funeral for my 26-year-old son because the one thing that was created to keep all type 1 diabetics alive was priced out of reach for him. We live in the 21st century, not 1921. This shit had never occurred in the U.S. Prior to discovery of insulin, type 1 was a certain death sentence. There was no treatment available. What we need is for someone to stand up to pharma, to hold them accountable for unjust price increases, to hold them accountable for patients evergreening, and force them into transparency and to operate business ethically. I believe it's the job of our Attorney General to go after pharma when big price increases have occurred over and over and over again. Every day that we sit and talk about how to handle Big Pharma, every day that we waste not passing bills, every day that we allow Farmer to point fingers at everyone else and try to deflect the attention from himself, people are dying. We need to stand up and put a stop to Farmer's pricing patients out of their Medicaid. So I'm asking all of you today, will you give the Attorney General Keith Ellison the tools to do his job that we elected him to do? Thank you.
Mr. Holt, I just wanted to say thank you so much for being here today, and our deepest sympathies to you, and we really appreciate you speaking about this and your advocacy on this issue. So thank you very much.
I won't go away. I will not stop.
Please don't. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. If the testifier would stay there, I do have one question. There are some other bills I know floating around the legislature that have to do with the cost of prescription drugs, and I know I signed on to one, I think, that had to do specifically with insulin, and I'm just wondering if the testifier knows about those other bills that are floating around and if you're supportive of those or if you have an opinion.
I know of a couple of them.
Okay.
I can't name them by name.
Yeah. That's fine.
But I do know of a few of them, and I'll be there for them, too.
Okay.
Thank you. I believe you have more testifiers. Chair Lesh?
All right. Madam Chair, we have the Minnesota Nurses Association. Ms. Roach?
Good morning, Chair, and members of the committee and fellow patients. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association membership in support of HF4. My name is Rose Roach. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Nurses Association, representing more than 20,000 nurses across Minnesota. A patient arrives in the ICU. The patient is in a diabetic coma. The patient is intubated and provided necessary medication, therefore regaining consciousness approximately 48 hours after admission to the ICU. Upon waking up and having the intubation tube removed, the ICU nurse asks the patient what happened. How is it that they ended up in a coma in the ICU? The patient responds, "I am a type 1 diabetic, but so is my son. He cannot afford his insulin, so I share mine with him." This is a true story, as experienced by MNA's own president, Mary Turner. Unfortunately, what happened to this patient is all too common and highlights two major cost drivers within our dysfunctional healthcare system: the inhumane and unnecessary high cost of prescription drugs, and how those costs create an environment in healthcare that causes us to be penny wise and pound foolish. Nurses are horrified as they watch pharma reap record profits by exploiting sick people who will pay anything to stay alive. When Goldman Sachs asked in a biotech report in April of 2018, quote, "Is curing patients a sustainable business model?" It's clear to nurses we've lost our way when it comes to ensuring the public's health. The price of pharmaceutical drugs has skyrocketed over the past three decades. The price of insulin alone has risen 1,200% over the past 20 years, making it the fifth most expensive liquid in the world. It is estimated that one-fifth of all diabetics are rationing their insulin, leaving 30 million Americans at risk of death due solely to the price of insulin. Would it not be much more cost-effective to ensure stability of drug costs as a means of not only saving the lives of the patients requiring those drugs so that they can live a full and productive life, but to also help control costs within the system as a whole? Bringing insulin, whose medicinal properties haven't changed in those 20 years, back to a reasonable price makes much more sense than spending $15,000 per day once the diabetic patient ends up in the ICU. For nurses, the answer is obvious. The basic economic principles of supply and demand do not apply to healthcare. You are either sick or you're healthy. You either need life-sustaining medication or you don't. You don't choose to be a type 1 diabetic simply because there's a sale on Novolog. It doesn't work that way. Unlike nurses, the market will never put patients before profits. Just as nurses advocate for their patients at the bedside, the Attorney General is entrusted with advocating for patients across the state. It's why MNA supports HF4 and and the efforts that empower the AG to protect patients from unconscionable pricing and predatory behaviors by pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceuticals make up approximately 10% of overall health care costs, but they represent one of the most rapidly rising sectors of cost. It is imperative that we act now before drug costs swallow, pun intended, the remaining slices of the health care pie. Please pass HF4. The need to act is urgent with people's lives literally at stake. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roach. And Chair Lesh, did you have any other testifiers in support?
No, I think we just have opposition.
So I think what I'd like to do at this point is open it up for, well, let's, why don't, I shoot you standing up. Why don't you go ahead, come forward, let's hear your testimony, and then we'll open it up for questions. All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates, and I am here today on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, which is the leading trade association for generic and biosimilar manufacturers. AAM is opposed to House File 4 as currently drafted. I want you to know there's a national market for generic medicines which provide tremendous savings to patients and taxpayers. In 2017 alone, the use of generic and biosimilar drugs saved Minnesotans $3.8 billion. In fact, 90% of all prescriptions are filled with generic medicines, but that only accounts for 23% of the total drug spend. The state of California recently released a report, and among its findings were that the 25 most expensive generic drugs represented only 8% of the spend and less than 1% of insurance premiums, and the highest year-to-year price increases for generic drugs were only 4.7% of the total spend on prescriptions. Generic and biosimilar medications are not driving spending on prescription drugs. I also want to note that there are generic companies that are working very hard to bring either generic or biosimilar insulin to market, and it is working its way through the process at the FDA. House File 4 is similar to Maryland's law passed in 2017, which was found by the federal courts to violate the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And on February 19th, the Supreme Court denied review of the Fourth Circuit's earlier decision holding Maryland's drug pricing law unconstitutional and in violation of the Commerce Clause because a state may not regulate commercial transactions that occur wholly outside of its borders. And like Maryland, most financial transactions related to generic drug prices occur outside of Minnesota. Additionally, House File 4 provides no meaningful standards that would allow companies to know whether they are compliant with the law. It prohibits unconscionable prices and defines unconscionable as not justified. Given the vague and arbitrary standards set forth in the bill, companies would perpetually be at risk of facing prosecution for taking actions that occur in the normal course of business. And finally, the bill would create a private right of action. This provision would permit anyone to bring a lawsuit whenever they believe a price is unconscionable, again using the vague terms included in the bill. Drug pricing is an extremely complex process that includes many entities within the drug supply chain and a significant number of federal laws. Thus, consumers should not be empowered to bring litigation that could ultimately result in drug cost increases, as manufacturers are forced to defend themselves against what could be numerous and frivolous lawsuits. Minnesota is home to at least three generic drug manufacturers who are small to medium-sized businesses in Baudette, Maple Grove, and New Hope. Should any of these companies be sued under the private right of action, the cost of defending their pricing, even if found to be appropriate, would increase prices or could even put them out of business. While AAM opposes House File 4, we and our member companies look forward to continuing to work with all stakeholders and legislators to address concerns related to drug pricing and to enhance access to generic and biosimilar medicines to lower prescription drug prices for Americans. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. So now we'll open it up to members, and I think Representative Lucero, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is to the bill author. Based on this testimony, could you explain the private right of action?
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, it's my favorite part of the bill. It says that to sue under this section is for the benefit of the public, and so it falls under the Private Attorney General Statute 8.31. If the Attorney General does not do it, you can hire your own attorney to ensure
that you have access to life-saving medications so your child does not die, and you can get attorney's fees for that.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. So is this a unique clause to essentially, if I understood you correctly, a private citizen can act under the authority of the attorney general is what I'm understanding. And then how common is it to have a clause like this in other statutes, I guess?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, yes. Section 8.31 is old. I don't know how old, maybe Mr. Gilbert knows, but it's been on the books for at least decades at minimum. And we're saying that this is a part of that. So there's a list of things that the Attorney General has a right to sue under, consumer fraud, other things to protect the public. And we're saying that protection from unconscionably high prescription drug price increases is included in that public benefit. So we're adding it essentially to the list of that under 8.31 that includes private right of action.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. One last question then on Subdivision 8, severability. I noticed that was included as well. Do you anticipate any portions of this bill that might be found unconstitutional or something to that effect that would require this clause? Or what was your driver for including this in here?
Well, Madam Chairman, Representative Lucero, I include severability clauses in any bill or contract that I write. Any good lawyer would. To ensure that if some cockamamie judge 40 years from now decides that it's unconstitutional, that it's preserved for the protection and benefit of the public. The rest of it is.
All right, Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, Chair Lush, thank you for bringing this bill forward. So I have had a kidney disease since I was 16 years old, and there wasn't a medication for me until I was probably in my 20s, and I used to pay $5 for a month's supply. And a couple years ago, that drug went to $50 for a month. And that's just a copay. So this issue hits near and dear to me because I know $50 may not sound a lot to some people, and I was able to pay that, but a lot of people can't pay for those types of things, and I had to take that particular drug because the ACE inhibitors protected my kidneys. And so I couldn't take a generic. I couldn't take another kind of drug, so I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I am, and I don't know if there's my question is, I don't think that there is anything we can do about this, but as I'm reading the unconscionable prices for prescription drugs, I wish that there was more that we can do in this section because I did do some studying, some case studies around drug pricing, and, you know, they don't just look at the drug itself that they're developing and making a profit off of that. There's hundreds of other drugs that they're developing that never end up becoming something, so they look at it as they've lost billions of dollars or millions of dollars in producing those drugs, and they actually factor that in so that they could say, well, it's not unconscionable because we're trying to cover the fact that we've lost millions in all these other drugs and in their development and their R&D. So I wish that there was a way we could actually go further in saying that it has to just be looking at that particular drug and not justifying it with all of the other losses. But I don't know if that can be done in this or if there's anything we can do about that. And I'm just curious your thoughts around
it. Madam Chair and Representative Herr, I appreciate the comments because that's right. I mean, the manufacturers will say, listen, we we chase a lot of rabbits down rabbit holes and most of them don't work out and we still have to pay people for that. Mm-hmm. And the high price we get for the development of these this drug goes to compensate for that, and then one of those will pan out in the future. I get that. Okay, that's part of business. You hire an attorney, you know, for personal injury, and they take 30% or as high as 40% medical malpractice in some cases. Which is a high chunk of your award that pays the lawyer for all those other cases they chased that didn't work out. Okay, that's part of business. However, we're talking about price increases. Okay, so the pharma bro, when he bought up that that drug, the HIV AIDS drug, that was already in the field. That had been produced. It was in production. It had been distributed for a while. He simply raised the price of that because he could, because people would die if they didn't take it. It had zero relation to the cost of R&D or production of that drug or any other drugs. And that includes insulin, too. Okay, so insulin's been on the market, and going from $19 a vial to $300 a vial, whatever ridiculous amount, has zero to do with the development. And so that's what we're looking to get at here. The unconscionable statement gets that if it's related to production, then it's fine. But if it's not, and you're just squeezing sick people who are going to die because you can, you're who we're after.
Thank you, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lush. That's a great distinction. I appreciate that.
All right. Members, I believe we have four people who want to ask questions and about 5 minutes left I'd like to devote to this bill. So if you could please just get to your questions, that would be great. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chair Lush. As we heard in testimony earlier, there's already been a court ruling on a bill very similar to this in the Supreme Court. In the federal court system that ruled it unconstitutional. But we also heard that we have three manufacturers of the generic drugs in the state of Minnesota. And with that information, what that tells me, and I'm not sure if you're on the same page as me, is because they're located in Minnesota, those would be the only three manufacturers that we could actually apply this to. And with that, if we pass something like this, would that drive those companies out of the state of Minnesota? It really makes me wonder. I was looking, doing some little bit of research on this, and for every medication that the pharmaceuticals develop, they have about 13 that they go nowhere because they're not working. They're not suitable to create, or they're not doing what they're intended. So that's a lot of research and development. And then also in other countries across the world, they have stuff like this that limit how much can be paid. Some countries actually set the price. And in order for a company to sell something else, they have to sell other things. Those are the things that raise the cost of pharmaceuticals in the United States, so we pay about twice what everybody else does because of what other countries do. Now, if we do this, not only might the three manufacturers we have leave the state, and if it would happen to be found constitutional, even though it's similar to one and because of the separation clause that you have in here, I really wonder if any pharmaceutical companies would sell any medications to Minnesota. That's just something to think about.
Chair Lush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Johnson, thank you. I didn't know you were going to toss me a softball. I would note, you go to any other country, okay, and they do not get squeezed for prescription drugs the way we do. Why is that? Because Big Pharma wrote our laws. In those other countries, the people, the representatives of the people, wrote the laws. You know, I was in Mexico, first vacation I had in, I don't know, 10 years or something, with my wife in December, and she walks into one of those little pharmacies they have over in Mexico, and she's buying up all these EpiPens and stuffing them in her purse. I'm like, what the heck are you doing? She's like, are you kidding me? I get these things for pennies on the dollar down here in Mexico. I'm like, okay, whatever. We're going to buy another suitcase in one of the pharmacies to store more EpiPens and bring it back or something. But I'll tell you this. There is no question that in those other countries, the people are not squeezed and gouged the way Americans are because Big Pharma has written the laws here. And I would add this. You suggesting that somehow a court case in Maryland has the bearing here. That was a Fourth Circuit case, number one. This is a different bill. This is not the bill. And it was in fact, drafted by talented attorneys specifically with what the Fourth Circuit said in mind. Now, we're in the Eighth Circuit here, okay, in Minnesota. This is an entirely different circuit. And so while a decision from a Maryland court may be persuasive, it's not controlling. But there's another piece here that's important to remember. The reason why the Fourth Circuit struck down the law in Maryland related to a dormant commerce clause
claim. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Dormant Commerce Clause, okay, but it says that the right to price goods between states is reserved to Congress, that commerce between the states, okay, and that in certain instances, companies that sell goods across state lines, not all instances, right, because we do stuff all the time that could implicate Commerce Clause when we pass it routinely with respect to regulation, and it's just fine. One of the other things we're dealing with, trying to remember who's in tax committee here, but, okay, Representative O'Neill, so we deal with the Wayfair case, right? The carryover from the implications of that Wayfair case is huge. And it said South Dakota had the right to protect its citizens and make decisions for its own citizens with respect to taxation between the states, and states' rights held the day in delivering for the protection and safety of their own citizens, despite Congress's constitutional exclusive franchise to regulate commerce between the states. But the Supreme Court of the United States, not the Fourth Circuit, the Supreme Court of the United States said that in that case South Dakota was right. And here comes Mr. Gilbert to come to correct me on this. But the point is that that case, while it did not come from the Eighth Circuit, it came from the Supreme Court of South Dakota, runs contrary to what the Fourth Circuit Maryland case said in that case. So, like I said, Mr. Gilbert, correct me on this.
Keep your comments short, Mr. Gilbert.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will try to do that. And thank you, and I don't disagree with anything you said on that. But, you know, to the extent the constitutionality of the statute has been raised by anybody, I think in fairness there needs to be some background given. I'll try to make it very quick. But the Fourth Circuit decision was a 2-1 decision. There was an extremely strong dissent in that case. And among other things, that dissent relied upon what they referred to as the reality of the modern economy and the stream of commerce as it relates to that. The Wayfair case that Representative Lesch has referred to is a really important case that was decided after the Fourth Circuit case, and it was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, as Representative Lesch says, what the Wayfair case said, first of all, it changed decades of law in the U.S. Supreme Court precedent. It dealt with the collection of taxes, and there was precedent that existed prior to that decision that said that a company has to have an actual presence in the state for them to be required to collect sales and use taxes. The court said that's archaic. It's outdated. It doesn't reflect our modern economy. And what it did, it reversed all of that prior law, and it said you don't have to have a presence in the state. Again, that decision was reached after the Fourth Circuit decision, which came down on April 13, 2018. The Supreme Court decision was decided 3 months later. And again, the Supreme Court applied the Commerce Clause analysis to an out-of-state company with no physical presence in the regulating state. And again, based on the reality, as they described it, of the modern economy, they changed the law as it up to that date existed. I also want to make the point that both drug manufacturers and wholesalers of prescription drugs are already licensed in the state of Minnesota. If there was no basis to regulate them, they wouldn't be licensed in the state of Minnesota. And to the best of my knowledge, there's never been a challenge to that licensing requirement. And that's the Board of Pharmacy that actually licenses them because they sell and distribute drugs in the state of Minnesota. And there are other cases that are different than the Fourth Circuit case. There's a First Circuit case that rejected the same kind of reasoning that you found in the majority opinion in the Fourth Circuit decision. There's a federal district court case out of Arkansas that deals with pricing and PBMs and similarly found that the Dormant Commerce Clause wasn't violated. So anyway, that's just some of the background, I think, that gives, you know, some context to that Fourth Circuit decision. And finally, in terms of this suggestion about the standard for conscionability, there is what's referred to as a conscionability doctrine in the state of Minnesota. And it's not unique. It's in many, many states. And it involves the general concept of reasonableness. What's reasonable under the circumstances? and a price that is unreasonable under particular circumstances can be unconscionable. And under this particular statute, a price is unconscionable if it is not reasonably justified by the actual cost incurred in inventing, producing, distributing, and selling the drug, and any actual cost of an appropriate expansion of access to the drug to promote public health. So this goes to the question that we had over here as to what costs can be considered. Well, the costs are specific as to the particular drug that might be alleged to be unconscionable in terms of its pricing. So anyway, that's background. I'm sorry if I took up too much time, but I think it's important when you talk about the constitutional issues that you do it in context. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this question is for Chair Lesch or the testifier that came back up to the table. Well, the first question is for Chair Lesch. And with this definition of unconscionable, I see that there have been several amendments made to this bill in previous committees, and I didn't know if any of those changes were regarding that definition, if that definition is the original one that you started with or if it's been changed.
Charlie. Well, Madam Chair and Chair Scott, I don't even remember the amendments we made in other committees, but I know none of them dealt with the unconscionability portion. That's been there from the beginning.
Okay. And then my other question is I have concern over the word essential. Is a cholesterol medicine essential?
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Scott, the essentiality rubric is laid out in section, here we go, patented, covered under Medicare Part D, has been designated by the Commissioner of Human Services due to its efficacy in treating a life-threatening health condition or chronic health condition that substantially impairs an individual's ability to engage in activities of daily living. And then it lays out 30-day supply is $80. So that's not really my department as to whether or not cholesterol is or not, but we leave that to the really smart people to decide what's essential.
Just that.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think that is the word that gives me the most consternation with the definition, because essential for one person may not be, I think it's too vague. I guess we'll just put it that way. And even though you're leaving it up to who you would consider the Commissioner of Human Services, I find that word troubling, because a lot of patients are going to consider the drugs that they're taking as being essential to them, but whether they're essential under this vague definition is to me it's too murky. But I do agree that there has to be something done about the issue, particularly of insulin, because I heard that on the campaign trail, and I'm like, well, insulin's been around forever, right? So I do think there is something that needs to be done. I'm just not sure that this bill in its language is the right thing, but thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Chair Scott. And I would just note, too, that I've heard this not only with respect to insulin, but the EpiPens that you mentioned and asthma medication. I've also heard from constituents about those drugs as well. I believe, Representative Barr, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the lady that was testifying with for the generics, and I'm just going to go ahead and get started with the question while you're on your way down. Save a minute here. My question is to Madam Chair
Ms. Cook,
thank you. My question has to do with patent law, and I believe it's what is the number of years that's patent and on drugs, and then why is insulin still covered under patent? If it is covered under patent, if it is not, why are there not more generic drug manufacturers producing this to actually put some market force back into this so that the price doesn't go through the roof? And that's just with the insulin, and then I have a follow-up.
Ms. Cook.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Barr. I will do my very best with this, but I probably will need to get some more information and follow up with you. But I'll tell you a little bit about what I know. So my understanding
you know, I'm not even going to tell you how long patent law is. It varies. I think we're, somebody else can probably give you a better idea. I think we're in the 15 to 20 year range, but there are ways in which patents can be extended as drugs are changed, improved, whatever. In terms of the insulin issue, it is actually a complex drug. It's been around for a long while, so my understanding of what's happening is that companies are trying to bring it to market as a generic, and the FDA is now changing course and suggesting that it has to be brought to market as a biosimilar, which is a very different pathway. And so it is just, I think, even though it's been around for a long time, it is a complex product, and so that's what has been the delay for bringing a generic to market. I just one other thing on asthma inhalers. So 2 weeks ago, a generic Advair asthma inhaler was released, and it set a 70% discount off the brand. So hopefully that is helpful to some of your constituents. Representative Barr.
Madam Chair and Ms. Cook, can you shed any light on the wholesale part of this? Because I was in a briefing about 2 years ago that was talking about there's 78% of all drugs manufactured in the United States run through three wholesalers licensed by the federal government, which puts an extreme bottleneck on the pricing because those three basically control the price between the actual pharmacist like CVS or Target and Eli Lilly or Bayer, the manufacturer, and a lot of the pricing has to do with those three. Could you shed any light on that for us, please?
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative Barr, I'll be as brief as I can on this. So actually 90% of all generics are sold through the three largest wholesalers, and those are national contracts, and those are prices that fluctuate almost on a daily basis based on what's needed, how much his product is out there. It's actually very, very complex pricing system on the generic side, which is a commodity market, versus the brand side, which is a monopoly market. And I know we're getting a little far afield.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just a last statement, I guess. My wife is a liver transplant recipient. She does not. She's got 7.5 years of extra life simply because of the pharmaceutical companies. She would not be here without that anti-rejection medicine. So I understand exactly where you're coming from, and I get your pain because I almost lost my wife, and I will lose my wife if pharmaceutical companies are not allowed to sell. And I'm looking at these prices on here, and they're nowhere close to what we're paying for her medications to keep her alive. I could very well be joining you, sir, and I want to make sure that doesn't happen to my wife or other people. So I get where you're coming from, Chair Lesh. I really do understand this. From a very personal standpoint, but I think we're taking the wrong tactic on this. I believe the federal government is the one that's putting the restrictions in, especially on insulin drugs, when they're changing the rules, and then the wholesale market, where we're not allowed to put any kind of free market competition in here, is controlled by, most of this is controlled by three wholesalers that are only licensed by the federal government. I think the government is the one that's standing in the way of keeping these prices down and making sure that people like this man's son have paid entirely too much for insulin, and some of the other testifiers are paying entirely too much for a drug that should have been licensed under generic many, many years ago and had many manufacturers so we could keep these prices down.
Okay. So here's where we're at, members. We are supposed to convene in about 10 minutes. We still have a couple of other bills. I'm wondering if we can go until 11:30 because we had testifiers from House File 1197 here yesterday. We pushed them over to today. And so what I'm hoping to do is wrap this up for a vote, move to 1197, and at least get some of the testifiers able to testify today. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. So, Chair Considine, did you have I have you down as a question for this. Are you good?
I do. And it's for the Attorney General guy.
That would be
please,
Mr.
Please,
Al
let's
Gilbert.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, his name is Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Gilbert, sorry. The word I find most troubling in all this discussion is death. And if a drug is found to be unconscionably high, is there a mechanism in place where they could hold the people that are responsible for the death of Mr. Holt's son and other people?
Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chair, Representative, the bill, as Representative Lesch indicated, is part of Section 8.31, which is the Attorney General's authority to pursue various remedies, which could include damages. It also authorizes private lawsuits, as Representative Lesch has indicated as well, that could include damages.
But not criminal charges to hold them accountable for the deaths.
Chair Lesch or Mr. Gilbert?
Madam Chair and Representative, Section 8.31 is a civil statute, so it doesn't deal with criminal liability, but to the extent there would be any criminal statutes applicable, that would be something the county attorneys would enforce.
Thank you. Chair, I'd like a roll call, please.
Okay. Before we do that, we didn't open it up yet to public testimony. Was there anyone from the audience who wished to testify on this bill? All right. Chair Lesch, did you have any final comments?
No.
All right. So at this point, I move that House File 4 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. We have had a motion for or a request for a roll call, so the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Lesch?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
Yes, with reservation.
Representative Barr?
No.
Representative Cantrell?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
Yes.
Representative Grossel?
Yes, with Chair Lesch's willingness to continue to work on this.
Okay. Representative Hassan?
Yes.
Representative Herr?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Mariani? Representative Noor?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Pass.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Zhang?
Yes.
Okay. We have 12 ayes and... All right.
Representative O'Neill?
Okay. There being 12 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. House File 4 is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All right, next, if we can move to House File 1197. Yes, and members, these other two bills, the intent is to lay them over, so I'm hoping we can finish actually both and then not have to return this evening. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Chair Lesch, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Yes, yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Chair Lesch moves House File 1197 to be laid over for inclusion in the Data Practices Omnibus Bill. And go ahead, Chair Lesch, and tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 1197 creates a framework for the protection of Minnesota's privacy in the digital age. It provides reasonable privacy protections for emails and other electronic information where federal law has failed to do so. It hasn't caught up with the level of technology that we're using to surveil our innocent citizens. The bill requires law enforcement to get a search warrant based on probable cause in order to access your personal, private, digital information, including content, location, metadata, and device searches. It specifically addresses a loophole in current federal law, which was enacted in the mid-1980s, that allows law enforcement to access emails that are more than 180 days old without a warrant by requiring a warrant regardless of duration of storage. It also includes notice, reporting, and enforcement provisions to make sure that there is proper transparency and oversight and mechanisms to ensure that the law is followed. That's sections 4, 5, and 6.
The language is based on the California ECPA, which has become a national model for digital privacy protection supported by a diverse coalition of tech companies and civil rights organizations. Members, the reason for this bill is that your life has changed substantially since you were a little kid, and your children's lives are going to change substantially between now and when they're your age now. The watchword of the future and who pulls the strings will be those who control the information. And right now, the folks who are collecting the information are doing it under the auspices of doing the right thing and trying to catch bad guys, etc. But we have had enough examples of doing the wrong thing for the right reasons in recent history, in fact, that establishes that this bill, setting specific parameters, guardrails for how we collect innocent people's data, of why that's important. I'll use one example, members, and that was the USA Patriot Act, passed only a couple months after 9/11 in 2001. That act was put forward by the intelligence community and by law enforcement in the wake of 9/11, which was a national tragedy. And it was done so with the promise that we were going to stop the bad guys who just caused us so much pain. And it was voted for broadly, bipartisanly. My own congresswoman voted for it. It was very broad support of that bill. It was in the years after that folks started to realize how bad of an idea this was, both sides of the aisle, and how we had to repeal all these sections because we were convinced to do something overbearing at a moment of great tragedy or because of loss. So you will hear testimony about why we need these powers to stop the bad guys. But I would ask you to balance that against the things that happen to innocent people because of our overreach. So that's the reason for it. I would introduce Mr. Ben Feist, who's representing Minnesota ACLU as well, for testimony.
Go ahead, Mr. Feist. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Ben Feist, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We are here in support of this bill today. As you know, the legislature has grappled with these technologies in the digital age, and this really is a framework for trying to get a grasp of what's going on and to ultimately empower Minnesotans to take control of their own digital privacy. Many of our existing statutes regarding electronic communications are based on this 1980s framework, and while little pieces have been picked away at over the years, and this committee is often responsible for doing that, we still feel that we're significantly behind the times. Existing privacy law in other areas typically requires the police to get a warrant before searching the file cabinet or computer in your house or the letters in your mailbox. Now that technology has advanced, state laws need to be updated to require the same warrant protections when the police want to read your emails, text messages, or other digital documents. Nearly all of us rely on mobile devices and the internet to connect, communicate, work, manage our finances, and research information, including on sensitive topics such as politics, health care and treatment, and organizing for social change. Minnesota residents should not have to choose between using technology and keeping their personal lives private. So this bill is based on a model known as the CalECPA, or Electronic Communications Privacy Act, that did draw support from both advocacy organizations like the ACLU and many in the tech industry, specifically in, all seem to be out in California. And that's notable, I think, because the ACLU and the tech industry don't often agree on most things, especially when it comes to privacy rights in the current state of things. So I think it's really meaningful that they were able to vet something that worked. And from the tech company's perspective, having some uniformity across the states in how law enforcement can access the information that tech companies are holding is actually very valuable. So this bill was put together with that in mind. Now, as you will hear from some of the other testifiers today, they have concerns about some of the perhaps unintended consequences or conflicts with existing state law that have come out of this framework. And we intend to continue to work with Representative Lesch and all of the stakeholders to address all of those issues before this moves any further. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. And before you do that, let's go ahead and get our other testifiers in who wish to testify on this bill. I believe you were the only supporter that's testifying. We might have some folks that are opposed to this bill. So why don't you come on down, please? And welcome to the committee and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Matt Gottschalk. Would you like me to begin my testimony now?
Yes, go right ahead. Thank you so much.
I'm the Chief of Police from Corcoran, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. The association represents over 300 chiefs across Minnesota that lead agencies of all sizes. Our association has several concerns over this broad proposal, many of which will be touched on by my colleagues in law enforcement testifying after me. Some of our biggest concerns include, as drafted, the bill completely disrupts our current warrant standards and sets new standards simply based on technology, which creates inconsistency and confusion by basing the type of warrant on technology rather than our existing long-established and reasonable warrant standards. The time frame standards to issue a warrant, we believe, should mirror the current 7 to 10 day standards that we currently operate under rather than the references to 3 days in the bill. The emergency language in subdivision 5 does not allow for exigent circumstances that it could include incidents like kidnapping, missing persons, human trafficking victims, because it only refers to death or serious physical injury. Additionally, the destruction of information and evidence provisions set a completely different standard from normal retention schedules for both active and inactive investigations. The destruction of this information will result in incomplete case files kept for many years as a result of our existing data retention laws. Furthermore, in many law enforcement investigations, our officers cannot yet tell what is exculpatory or not within the 30 days outlined for destruction of much of the information. There's other concerns that some of the other testifiers will share, and the bill's overall scope is of concern, and we're still working through the implications and unintended consequences of the bill, but those are the largest general concerns from our membership. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Chief. Thanks for being here, and thanks for coming back, too. Let's see, who's next? We've got another. Why don't you come on forward? Welcome. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin.
Thank you. In light of time, I'll try to be brief. My name is Dan Bianconi with the Dakota County Sheriff's Office, and I'd like to get started on some of the areas of concern. Item 4.4, it's a 30-day timeline. From my perspective, my job is to oversee our investigations. I also manage our electronics crime task force, which solely manages and processes digital evidence. A 30-day timeline is almost impossible to comply with. There was a time in my career when electronics weren't really part of investigations, but they're a part of every investigation now. And with the 30-day timeline, we're going to be put in a position where we either have to do incomplete investigations because we can't get to the devices in time, or we're going to be in a situation where we have to make a decision to prioritize or triage investigations based on severity. That's an argument that we don't want to have to come to when we're speaking with victims. When you're a victim, your case is the most important investigation, and you're not going to have a lot of sympathy to deal with law enforcement having to comply with a 30-day timeline. That's one major area of concern for us. The line 4.15, the appointment of a special master, that's also concerning. The special master requirement removes law enforcement discretion from the investigation, and the analysis of investigative data depends on the discretion of a third party, an appointed special master. We spend an awful lot of time, energy, and money investing in our staff, training over years, perhaps decades, to complete these investigations, to be trained so that they're competent to handle this. Now we're going to be turning over discretion to a third party. There's no assurance. There's no requirement of a special master as to their competency. Would they even be able to take a look at the raw data produced by our forensic examiners and know what they're looking at, it takes our staff a lot of time and training to get to that competency level, another area of concern. The appointment of a special master will certainly take, will add time to the investigation. And that's concerning because it does affect case outcomes. We lose track of witnesses. We lose track of victims who circumstances potentially change. Maybe they've moved on. They're stable again. They don't want to perhaps heal from that crime. They don't want to reopen old wounds. The longer an investigation takes to complete, the more difficult we find in winning those prosecutions that result from our investigations. Two areas that I see that would be very problematic in appointment of a special master would be domestic violence cases and human trafficking investigations. Both of those types of investigations are very crucial to be timely. Currently, the Dakota County Sheriff's Office is conducting a domestic and sexual violence response review. We're looking at our procedures to see, are they in line with best practices? Are they being conducted in a forensic manner? We're undertaking this review through grant funds that we received through Violence Against Women Act. One problem that we've identified very early is the time an offender commits a crime, act of violence against a person, to the time that they're held to answer for it in court. The longer that time frame, the longer that they are not being held accountable. And so through work from this grant and another grant, we've actually seen our conviction rates go from the mid-50% to the mid-90s. It's not very often that we have success of that level. That's largely due because of the forensic evidence that we bring with electronic devices, largely in misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases. That's not the case in most electronic investigations. They're almost always your most severe and serious crimes. So we would be concerned with the appointment of a special master, as that will certainly add a layer of bureaucracy and a level of review that we don't believe is necessary. Second is the way investigations naturally expand. It could be a situation where we received a device to analyze. Perhaps it's a firearm investigation or a fraud investigation. Very commonly, we'll receive a search warrant to review a device for photos or for documents pertaining to a specific crime. And while they're evaluating and reviewing those devices for evidence of that crime pursuant to a search warrant, they will see evidence of another crime. A special master is not going to be required to report that information, nor will they have the expertise to report that information, or perhaps draw the associations from the raw data that they received from a forensic examiner and link that to an investigation. That's the job of the detective, and these people are highly skilled in this area. They seek specific training to age questionable child pornography, fraud, investigations of all types. The last section, 5.8, that I'd like to comment on is under the emergency section. I think generally there could be a misunderstanding, if I'm reading this bill, of how this device data is used. Primarily under the emergency exception, that's a largely well-known warrantless exception to a search. And the reason and the way that law enforcement uses the emergency exception is almost always in situations where we're locating missing persons, we're locating people with dementia, people who have been in a car crash and maybe don't know where they are, situations where pings or location GPS located services from internet service providers are given to law enforcement almost immediately so that they can be sent help. And that's primarily almost always how that order is used. It's never in a case of a criminal apprehension or to build evidence of a crime. If we're going to go pursue evidence in a crime, we'll get a search warrant. Merely locating a person is not usually going to be the evidence that's going to help us in a criminal case. So it's almost always in those type of mental health or accident type situations.
Okay, thank you. Are there more testifiers in opposition here? And if you could please try to keep your comments to as brief as possible. Welcome back, Superintendent.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I would echo much of what my colleagues have noted throughout. And in particular, what I'd like to know for the committee from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's perspective is that we spend a lot of time and resources working very hard on behalf of the citizens of this state to identify those that are harming and pursuing our children online through technology-facilitated crimes, including internet crimes against children, child pornography, human trafficking cases, and others along the way. I would like to note just a couple of things as we work through this, that our main concerns are is that there's a number of unintended consequences that may cause significant confusion by a number of the definitions and the provisions within this. We readily agree that we want to protect all of Minnesotans' privacy interests as we're working through these investigations, and all of us in law enforcement have a specific interest in ensuring that we gather any evidence we do in a criminal investigation in a legally permissible way so that that evidence can be presented in court to hold those accountable that are harming our citizens across Minnesota. One thing that I would like to note, and I've had this discussion with Mr. Feist from the ACLU, a lot of these provisions, as Chair Lesh noted, can become confusing as to which apply, whether the federal law, which laws apply from different states. There is the loophole that we're talking about trying to close when it comes to emails that are over 6 months old. That is a federal loophole. It does not apply to the states. We have never been able to get email in this state using that federal provision that is older than 6 months old. We've always had to get a search warrant in Minnesota to get that. Federal authorities can and will continue to be able to get that email older than that from that time period, but your state and local agents have not been able to do that. Our digital multimedia laboratory does a lot of evidence examination, and some of the time frames that were noted by my colleagues, we share similar concerns. Our current turnaround time in the BCA's digital multimedia evidence laboratory is, for example, over 4 months currently pending in our child pornography cases. Having to examine and destroy potential information or evidence in those cases would severely hamper our efforts as we're working through those. In addition, the BCA would never be in a position to destroy any evidence in a particular case until defense attorneys and others have had an opportunity to review that information, for example. And so we would like the opportunity, as we said, we have concerns about a number of provisions working throughout the entirety, really, of the bill in terms of a number of definitions and what provisions would apply when. I agree that our world has changed in many ways because of technology and moving forward. We do have a search warrant provision, as provisions in our current statutes that apply to most digital multimedia evidence now. There's very few exceptions in terms of content that we would receive that we would not need a search warrant under current law to receive and obtain in our criminal investigations if we want them to be admissible into court, with the exceptions that are already in the 626A chapter that you're reviewing, that you're considering putting in here. So we would welcome the opportunity to work with the chair, other stakeholders, as we examine some of these issues moving forward so that it's very clear which provisions apply where if we were to move this bill forward moving forward.
Thank you, Superintendent. I have a question for maybe you and or Mr. Feist, because we were talking about the provisions we already have in statute, but I'm just wondering about constitutional provisions, because I heard some, I think Mr. Feist testified about needing a warrant for emails and text messages. We want to be able to have that with this bill, but it's my understanding under Fourth Amendment case law analysis that that kind of warrant is already required. Am I missing something about that? Go ahead, Superintendent.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we have a fairly simple rule when we're teaching our agents how to make the determination if you need a warrant or not, regardless of what the companies may do. If it is content-based, whether it's a text message, whether it's an email, whether it's an actual message on a phone, you are required to get a warrant. If we can see what people were communicating back and forth, you need a warrant. Pen register and other provisions under 626A, if we're simply seeing dialed digits in and out, we see people communicating via text, but we don't see the content of those text messages, that can be obtained via subpoena. And so we think of it as transactional versus content. Content-based, we teach them that they need to get a search warrant. If it's transactional in nature, the subpoena provisions likely are the oversight that we need in that particular instance.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Lucero, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Chair Lesh for this this bill. And the law is not keeping up with technology. And I think this is a great attempt to begin to catch us up in with the modern times and the modern capabilities that technology is allowing. Now, there are, I think, some legitimate concerns, as we've heard here, and I know that Chair Lesh will work to improve this bill, but I just want to give a big thank you for this, and I'm proud to be a co-author.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, and kind of took the words right out of my mouth, Representative Lucero, and I'm proud to be a co-author on this, too, and I would like to see some work done. I think there were some really legitimate points brought up, and I know that, you know, in all your spare time, you'll be working on them.
Any other questions from the? Okay. Chair Lesh, did you have any final comments?
Sure. Madam Chair, thanks. In general, I really like working with these guys, too. I'll tell you they're pretty easy to work with. And I know that when some previous legislators left, they probably got really nervous. Oh, here we go. Now we got to deal with Lesh and Scott and Limmer, right? They're not going to say anything. But they're pretty easy to work with on this, and hopefully we can find some middle ground or something. But Mr. Feist is easy to work with, too. I wanted to point out that the focus on victims, and I understand, you know, this is their job, okay? When I was in college, I had a roommate who had a guard dog, and that guard dog was great, okay? And they started barking when things coming toward us. So we made sure we kept the guard dog on a leash, though. We didn't let him go running off. But it was a very important protective measure that we had that made us feel safe. And I appreciate the focus on victims that we have when we have laws in place that are meant to protect us from dangerous individuals. But I would note, the first bill we had on the calendar today, you remember that? Okay, women coming up saying, why do I have to get fingerprinted and asked if I'm a sexual predator on children because I want to adopt my own kid? That effect came from us looking out for victims and looking out for kids. And the spillover of that overreach caused us to have unintended consequences. We had to deal with that bill today. And the same thing happens when we over-rely on simply one analysis of how are we going to protect the victims. There are other things that we need to deal with, too. And I wanted to point this out, members. I believe it was, okay, yeah, it was a chief in Minnesota, and I can't even remember who told me this, said he went out, this was years ago, to the FBI, because they all work with FBI and all the big shots out there and rub elbows with them, and said that he ran into the FBI director. That FBI director kept under the glass on his desk a letter signed by Robert Kennedy, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, and the letter gave permission to J. Edgar Hoover to wiretap Martin Luther King Jr. And the basis for that was that Martin Luther King Jr. was a communist, as an insurrectionist, and he was a danger to America and the American way of life. And Dr. Martin Luther King turned out to be the most spied-on citizen in American history because of that, okay? All under the basis of public safety and protecting people from him. Now, we have a bust of MLK at the base of the Capitol steps in the Capitol right now. Okay, this insurrectionist. And I just wanted to point that out, that sometimes there are other things to consider than how are we going to get the bad guys. Because sometimes the bad guys, we end up roping in folks who aren't the bad guys, but they're a threat to our silo, not necessarily a threat to America. So that USA Patriot Act that I brought up at the beginning of the hearing, law enforcement had been asking for those powers for many years, okay, and they were able to get them under a period of national grief and national mourning in the name of the victims of 9/11. And I think that everyone recognizes now that that was an overreach. I think most of law enforcement recognizes that was an overreach, too. And so this law is meant to set up parameters so that we reduce those moments of overreach. All that said, I recognize that law enforcement has a major problem. They really don't like this bill. I get that,
okay? And I want to be able to work with them to see if we can come up with some result here. So that's the end of my comments. And I talked too long, Madam Chair. But
that's all right. It's city. Anybody else in the audience that wanted to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none.
One last thing, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. That FBI director who I just looked this up to look up the letter that kept that letter, that RFK letter about wiretapping Martin Luther King Jr. on his desk, turned out to be James Comey. Okay. All right. Now, the reason this is important.
Okay, I'm going to start to draw the line here now. Come on. It's 11:35.
Okay. I'll just leave it at that.
All right. We're opening a whole can of worms we don't want to go into there. All right. So House File 1197 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Data Practices Omnibus Bill. Members, do we want to do 1196 now or do you want to come back tonight?
Madam Chair.
Yep. Go ahead.
I think we can do 1196 on next week.
Oh, all right then.
Well, what?
We've posted.
Who's here? Is anyone here for 1196 now?
Nope. Many of us have committees tonight, committee
hearing
already.
So. Right.
Yeah, what?
So we prefer to have 1196 next week? Are we
or
able
do
to
do
that?
Or do you want to do it now? It's going to be laid over.
I'd rather wait on it, Madam Chair. I think we can do it quick, and I don't want to do it now.
Okay.
Because it's 11:35.
Well, right now we're meeting is scheduled
for Monday. Okay, currently we have a meeting scheduled for Monday evening.
Why?
This is
what?
The House File, it's House File 1500.
Is it a big one?
It's a non-compliant driver's license.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay.
We could add.
Let's add this to that. I'm sorry, Ben. We're going to add this to that.
Okay.
He'll be here anyway.
So it sounds like we're going to be adding House File 1196 to the Monday evening hearing. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Hey.